the technical committee meeting on the 14th of June. Welcome everyone, and a warm welcome to our friends from the Yellow Eyed Penguin Trust, and Dr. Palmer will introduce them in a moment. We'll just move through a couple of wee procedural things. Confirm the agenda as circulated. Are there any conflicts of interest? It would appear not. There's no matters of public forum. The minutes of the 3rd of May meeting are on your agenda and have been circulated. I'm happy to move them as true and correct. This is your seconder. Councillor Laws, I'll put it all in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, carried, thank you. And we note the apology from Councillor Beaker. So, Dr. Palmer, can you introduce our...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to welcome and introduce Dr. Eric Shelton, the Chair of the Yellow-Eyed Penguin Trust Board, Sue Murray, the General Manager, and Dr. Trudy Webster, the Conservation Science Advisor for the Trust. The work of Dr. Webster is part funded by ORC for a three-year period that commenced in 2015-2016. Dr. Webster started in about
February 2016.
Yep, so about halfway through that period, so we thought it was quite timely for the Trust and Dr. Webster and Co to update councillors on the work that's been achieved and plans for the future.
Thank you. Yes, in your hands.
Now, let's go very quickly through some background. Don't take too much as assumed knowledge, but the Yellow Penguin has become, over the years, part of the Otago brand. There's been a deliberate move by the tourism sector to create and develop it, and then eventually, of course, to extract revenue from it. And it's hard to miss the iconography around Dunedin City, like through the rubbish bags, but that's whether or not it should be or not, it's another matter. There it is, and quite a little note all over the place. So, locally important, and the contribution to the economy was in 2007. There was estimated to be $100 million come into Dunedin from the whole of the wildlife sector. So it hasn't been broken down by attraction, but obviously the private attractions know what their turnover is. But we're looking at something like $100 million directly. And that's not taking into account the multiplier. And so then, directly and indirectly, we're looking between 800 and 1,000 jobs in the city. And this study was done a decade ago. It hasn't been repeated, but with the growth of the tourism industry locally, that would definitely have gone up. So the distribution was sort of locally important, but also nationally, and in terms of conservation, internationally important. And the breeding range, as you can see, is down the east coast of the island. And then it moves over to Auckland Island and Campbell Island. Now we've got good population measures for the mainland. We haven't got particularly good population measures for the Southern Antarctic Islands. And the thing about the penguins is that they turn up all over the place. It looks like we've got birds that go from Catlins turn up on the Canterbury Bight. We've had birds turn up in Wellington. They're moving all over, and not necessarily the same birds. But if we look at the numbers so far, and this is what led to a fairly vigorous response on our part, there's been a continual decline now since 2008. And one of the things about the numbers is we always work on breeding pairs. So it may well be that you see more birds than we would count. And that gives you a stable measure over the years. And as I said, there's an unknown number in the Southern Antarctic. But now those numbers are down on the mainland to 260 and from what was 570 breeding pairs in 2008. And so, later Trudy will explain what might be lying behind this, but you can see that given the bird is so important locally and financially, it's a major issue if the numbers are going to be declining in this way. Just very, very briefly, in terms of reasons for the claim. We're looking at a cumulative impact, and so you may be familiar, or you would be familiar, with the idea of a cascade. If enough variables change within an ecosystem and you get the right trigger, you can end up with a cascade of extinctions. And many people believe that we may be facing something like that at the moment. In terms of land-based predators, there's been a lot of work done to eliminate or reduce the effects of land-based predators, to the extent that that's pretty well under control. If somebody came along and said it's essential that we get on top of land-based predators, we could confidently say we are already on top of them. An ongoing program for that. And a human disturbance, if you take somewhere like Sandfly Bay, where there are 65,000 unregulated visitors per annum, we go back some years, every morning at Sandfly Bay, there were 25 birds came down from the headland, crossed the beach and swam away. Now many, many people are seeing one or two birds. So that we would put down mainly to human disturbance. And then we've had mass mortality events, and this has been a major issue. Totally healthy looking birds walk out of the surf, walk up the beach, halfway up the beach, they fall over dead. And never really been quite sure what's behind that, but Trudy will go into that in more detail. Now in terms of fisheries effects, fisheries interactions, we have lots of things going on in the fishing industry that it's very hard to get good figures for. And traditionally, the fishing industry has been reluctant to report deaths of birds. And that may be changing at the moment, and it may change more rapidly with the idle observers or cameras going on the boats. But historically, it's an industry that we haven't had a particularly good relationship with in terms of conservation versus what they do. Then the big one, climate change, and you can tell me more than I can tell you about that. Obviously there has to be, and to resist the temptation of saying everything's climate change and we can't do anything about it. And even if everything's climate change, it still doesn't mean that there aren't ways of intervening to the greatest benefit. And then disease. We've had a couple of diseases that have caused major problems, but at the moment we seem to be between major disease events, and that's really been covered there. So I'll leave you with that as my contribution. It's an alarm that we're sounding, but we're also going to be mentioning some things that we think we can do in response to the situation.
So I'm just going to introduce the role service, and it was following an approach to Stephen and Peter in 2015 the council's long-term plan that saw this position created with the idea of coordinating scientific investigation into the marine environment through an appointment of an in-house scientist with the Yellow Penguin Trust. And I won't read these out, you've got the handout in front of you, but these were the functions. So traditionally the Trust had always purchased science, and we decided that it was time that we had in-house science that would actually guide and give us independent advice for the work as we move forward. And so again, as Dr. Palmer said, ORC contributes $70,000 a year, and Otago Museum fund the other part of the position, with the Trust covering things like the initial recruitment process, again administrative support and associated costs to the role itself. So this is 3 years from both Council and from the Otago Museum, and obviously commitment from the Yellow Penguin Trust. So now I'd like to introduce Trudy. She was appointed in February 2016. She comes with a background in the marine environment, having done her PhD in the acoustic behaviour of southern right whales. And you might think, what's that got to do with penguins? it was Trudy's experience in the marine environment that was of interest to us, and that is what we wanted. There is many, many people out there that have the knowledge about the penguins, and we have great relationships with those people. What those people don't necessarily have is that understanding of all the factors that go on in a marine environment, and that's what we were looking for, and we think we found it in Trudy. And she also had a lot of experience with NGOs and an association, an existing association through the university as well, so all of those contacts were are very valuable to us. So I'll leave it over to Trudy to fill you in on what she's doing.
Thanks, Sue, for that introduction. So I'm just going to go through some of the key tasks that have been set up through my role. And in the bottom left-hand corner, I've written some implications for the Regional Council, just to help you see how that relates to you guys. So firstly, the major key task really is research. So this is using scientific evidence to learn what we can about the ecology of yellow-eyed penguins and the factors affecting them. So the first major part of this task is a literature review that I've undertaken, so looking at the marine and terrestrial threats to yellow-eyed penguins, and also looking at some recommendations for either future research or future management of the species. The next thing, as Eric mentioned earlier, is unexplained mortality events. So we had another incidence of this year. So as Eric said as well, seemingly healthy birds coming up the beach, they're well fed, and then they just seem to drop over and fall dead. We have sent lots of these birds off for post-mortem at Massey, and they come back and they all have the consistent thing that they all have is mass destruction of the red blood cells. And so this event can be tied back to the event in 2012 and then also a previous event in 1989-1990. So in 1989-90 we lost about 150 birds, the next one was sort of up to 70 birds. This year luckily it was only 9 birds, still, you know, when your population numbers are getting down it's still way too many. And just from the spatial and temporal spread of this, we think it's more likely to be a toxin rather than disease related, but we're still working on that. There's quite a lot of toxins in the marine and freshwater environment, so we're just trying to learn what we can about that. I've also been doing some work collating some bycatch fisheries data, so this is really from coastal fisheries and primarily set nets, and it really is a priority to try and understand the real impact on yellow-eyed penguins in fishing. Also working on a stable isotope project, so we're doing a bit of a comparison with some historical and contemporary feathers to look at changes in diet over time to see if that will highlight anything for us. There are various student projects that I'm working on as well. So I'm host supervisor for a student of wildlife management, on the advisory committee for a student, and then I give assistance to various other students, so ranging from sort of habitat projects to diet and foraging. We've got a student that's doing a drone project at the moment at IKEA to look at changes to the coastal topography, and in particular thinking about sea level rise and erosion and that kind of thing. Also doing a bit of work with a guy in marine science examining cats. That's basically penguin vomit, so not particularly glamorous going out collecting penguin vomit, but you can use it to look at little fish ear bones and fish bones and see what they've been eating. So the second key task is optimal species management. So really this is using science again to try and improve what we're doing with the birds, and continually, you know, re-evaluating what we're doing and seeing whether it's working and improving it if necessary. So we really need to ensure quality monitoring. Without that, we really, you know, without knowing how many birds and how successful they are at breeding and determining the status of those nests, we can't really learn what's affecting them and move on from there. So we also support conservation management efforts, so this is includes picking up birds for rehab and hospital, releasing them, supporting and advising other conservation organisations, right from the Catlins up to Bangor Peninsula. Another big part of my role is collating all this information and analysing it throughout the season, so both at a population and an individual level, looking at productivity and survival and that kind of thing. And I've just undertaken a big review of the season, basically looking at different aspects of what we've done this season and looking at what improvements we can make for next year. So whether this is in a practical sense, you know, more equipment to long-term, long-term effectiveness of our management efforts. We've also just got funding for a nest enhancement project. So this is out at Otapahi and Okea, two of our reserves on the peninsula. And we're looking at some targeted improvements of the nest sites through nest boxes and a bit of planting as well. Oh, thank you. I think I'm losing my voice from shouting too much at the rug last night.
Word here off the main thing.
All right. So another major task is using science to assess and improve. So part of my role to inform sort of policy and provide evidence for submissions. So a big part of this year was a role through the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is the red list of species that you might have heard of, so they give out the endangered and all the global statuses. We reviewed all 18 penguin species this year. In a global sense, the status of yellow-eyed penguins didn't change as part of that, but it was an interesting process to be part of. Also, under the Wildlife Act, we have to put in many permit applications to support our work, so this is for handling and manipulating the birds as well. I've also been sort of providing lots of evidence and writing submissions for different processes. So on here we've got the Southeast Marine Protection Forum, so along the coast here looking at protected areas across the region, particularly with relation to yellow-eyed penguins and how that may affect them. There was a big fisheries review this year, so management of fisheries, and this was talking about sort of discarding of fish and trawling and electronic monitoring, that kind of stuff. Marine protected area legislation, that's all about to change, so we had some input into that as well, and there were a few more that aren't on that list. So we also have some input into the prioritisation of fisheries funding, so this is through DOC and MPI, the Conservation Services Programme. DOC redid their threatened status this year, and so I provided them with some abundance and genetic information for yellow-eyed penguins, which has now led to an increase from nationally vulnerable to nationally endangered. So that's a slightly different classification system to the red list, but national classification. And another thing I've been working on is data for the MPI fisheries risk assessment. So providing them with some population data, which has again increased in risk level for the species. So, as you would expect, as a scientist, probably a good idea to do a bit of scientific representation. So this goes in a variety of different forums. I've got an honorary fellowship at Marine Science at the university here, which is really to ensure some good links with the department, good links to the staff and the students. Also means that I can use the equipment and, you know, I've got a good sounding board with lots of the staff and good relationships there. I was an invited member of the Penguin Specialist Group, which was through the IUCN, as I mentioned earlier. And I'm also a member of various seabird type groups, both locally and globally. So this is really just to keep up to date with some of the science and have those good links with the researchers. We've also got a local penguin research group that meets at the university to discuss all things penguin and researching. And as part of this, obviously, there's attendance at talks and scientific conferences. So I attended the International Penguin Congress in South Africa last year, which was super good. And actually, it's going to be in Dunedin in 2019. So that's going to be quite big for the city and quite cool. Various other national conferences. So as you heard earlier, the museum sort of funds part of my role as well, and I have some sort of specific tasks through those guys. So I'm involved in a lot of science and research and advocacy for penguins and in the wider marine environment. So this is a range of things from writing blogs, public outreach at sort of international science festivals and Sea Week, to assisting researchers with their work using the Otago Museum collection. So here I've given a couple of examples of, here's me looking at the muscle attachment in some crested penguins. It's a bit gory, sorry. But we also had another researcher looking at morphology and another one looking at ancient DNA and that kind of thing. Also been involved in some work on an unusual beach whale species, a stranding that occurs in the Chatham Islands and we've been finding regularly on our coast here as well. And another project that I'm hoping that I can progress a bit further is seabird feather bank, so using feathers for DNA and stable isotope analysis and morphology research, and this is in collaboration with the Australasian Seabird Group. Another key task is sort of more general science-related activities, so the normal sort of reviewing of abstracts and scientific papers for conferences and things, writing different funding applications, which seem to come around very quickly. I've also been involved in a project off in the Otago Canyon. This is a project that's being led by Marine Science Department here. And we're really trying to look at seabirds and marine mammals and their use of the canyon system, which is finding some really interesting stuff, considering they're so close off the coast here, really. No one's really been out to have a look, and we're trying to then relate that to the bathymetry and oceanography of the area. And in between, trying to publish some papers when I can, when I find the time. So also a big part of my role is public and media relations. This year it's been quite diverse. I've done a couple of TV interviews, some ODT and Dunedin TV interviews about my science role and also the decline in numbers. Did a piece with Alison Balance on National Radio. Also contributing to magazine articles, so New Zealand Geographic and Science World and Forest and Bird magazine. And also on the other end of the spectrum, kind of providing information for our newsletter and, social media, so Facebook posts and that kind of thing. And often I get lots of questions from school children, university students as well, which I often find they're very, very varied questions, so they're always quite interesting to answer to. So really a large part of my role wouldn't be possible without liaising with a huge variety of different parties and different stakeholders and visiting a large number of different sites. So there's lots of stakeholders that I've gotten to know over the last year or so, from iwi to different government departments, different research institutes, universities, tourism operators, local landowners, and the list kind of goes on. And as Eric was saying earlier, yellow-eyed penguins breed between Banks Peninsula and the subantarctic, so that's a lot of ground to cover, and this sort of covers private reserves, public beaches, conservation land, and also moving into the rehab facilities and hospital type setups as well. So this is covering the mainland and to tiny little islands off Stewart Island, so a whole variety of different places. And I just thought I'd finish, not quite finished, but a couple more slides. These are some of the recent developments which I think are quite important that might affect yellow-eyed penguins. So you may have heard of some of these. We've kind of alluded to a couple of them. So the first one was that DOC have raised the threatened classification to nationally endangered. It used to be nationally vulnerable. The next thing was the minister's release of the threatened species strategy. So basically this was a list of 150 priority species, of which the yellow-eyed penguin was one. And so really the goal is to enhance these populations by 2025. Another publication that got quite a lot of media attention, so you might have heard about it, is Thomas Matton's paper, which has been highlighting the decline in the penguins locally. So he did some modelling work at Boulder Beach, and this is his quite depressing graph here. So the red lines are the actual measured number of adult females, and the black line there is the sort of projection over time, and you can see that the thinking now is that they're going to be locally extinct at Boulder Beach by 2060, which is quite a depressing state of affairs because it's really not that far away. So the other thing that was released recently is the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, her report, which basically stated that 4 out of 5 of our native birds are in trouble and at risk of extinction. And I should have said earlier, with Thomas's work, a third of that variation over time was thought to be due to climate change, which means two-thirds of it was down to other stuff that he couldn't measure. So likelihood, fisheries, human disturbance, that kind of thing. So this is a where to next. What are we planning for the future? One of the big things that we're working on at the moment is the recovery strategy. So working with DOC and Ngāi Tahu as our key program partners, we're planning a recovery strategy for penguins, looking at the major issues and looking at a plan for how to resolve some of those or at least move ahead. There's some potential for working with a climate change modeller and maybe to tease apart some of the why sea surface temperature, which Thomas found in his research, how that is affecting yellow-eyed penguins. This is the measured variable, sea surface temperature, and the light changes in it aren't directly impacting the penguins, but this is obviously affecting the prey or something else in the system. So looking into what the mechanism behind that is. As I said earlier, looking to do some further investigations into the mass mortality events. I think that needs a lot more work, and hoping to do some GIS modelling of some of those impacts and see if we can tell from any of the environmental variables, you know, anything that's anomalous between years, or the same with the years that those events are occurring. I'm hoping to do some work with marine science and surveying. They've just bought a new bit of equipment that's a multi-beam echo sounder, and I think this could be used for lots of different things, looking at foraging habitats, impacts on the seabed, both from fisheries and from dredging and things like that. And also a good use of that would be designing protected areas, so looking at the areas that we need to protect and highlight for future protection. I'm continuing to do some work with MPI to estimate and reduce bycatch, and this is sort of both locally talking to MPI and fishermen, and nationally as part of a hopefully fisheries mitigation plan. I'm also keen to do some work with DOC on a seabird prioritisation project, and this involves some spatial and population modelling of threats to seabirds. Right, so I think this is my final slide. So really, how can we continue to work together and benefit each other? So I think that some of the unexplained mortality investigations, essentially, the ORC has you know, access to good data on water sources and water quality, temperature, rainfall, some of those environmental factors that I don't necessarily have the data for, so it would be great to work with you guys in the future on those kind of things. I think also we're obviously doing a lot of work on yellow-eyed penguins and the wider marine environment, which we're hoping can potentially feed into your biodiversity strategy. We've got a lot of knowledge of impacts and the marine and terrestrial habitats, which will be relevant to other species in Otago as well. there's obviously a big push towards predator free 2050, so this is involving lots of collaborations with different groups, and pest operations are obviously critical. It's one of the things that we can manage for yellow-eyed penguins, so we need to continue to do that into the future. Tourism, as we mentioned, is another big pressure on yellow-eyed penguins, particularly uncontrolled and unmanaged tourism, so working together to manage this better. I also mentioned the drone work right at the start that I'm doing with a student out at Victory Beach. And this is a potentially useful tool for you guys in the future if you're looking at sea level rise and erosion and topographic changes over time. We're doing several different mapping events of that area. And finally, just really the ongoing support of my role means that we can examine impacts on yellow-eyed penguins and help to manage them more effectively. Really, there are no quick or cheap answers in the marine environment. It requires sort of long-term support to start to investigate any of those issues. So, yeah, I just want to thank you all for your support so far, and thanks for listening to me.
Thank you, Trudy, for the update, and Eric and Sue. All right, there might be some questions, so let's open it up for discussion. Councillor Laws.
I was really interested in the mess unexplained mortality,
yep.
which more than anything else, including human and rodent,
yep.
Seems to be the greatest deprivation from yellow-eyed penguins. The last one occurred was about 10 years ago.
2012 was the sort of the last big one.
How much closer are you to finding out how they die? Because it seems extraordinary if you haven't, you know, 5 years after the event.
Yeah. So we have been undertaking post-mortem events. Obviously, we don't still have animals from the very early event. That was in 1890. But we've conducted post-mortems on a lot of the birds that, well, I haven't personally, Massey University did at the vets there. They've tested for several different toxins, so lots of the toxins that we know about in the marine environment. They've tested for heavy metals, all the regular things, and every time they're turning up a blank. And it's often really tricky to isolate a toxin in a bird. So even when you know that it's likely to be this thing, you know, you circumstantially it's pointing the finger to, I don't know, say lead contamination, it's often really hard to pick up in the system. If the bird's sort of vomited or whatever, it's then really hard to pinpoint that particular toxin.
So you ruled out viral?
So they ruled out several things, or they haven't found several things. I wouldn't say they've definitely ruled them out. So some of the things that they've ruled out, it could potentially still be. They just haven't found it. It's a very, and I think there's a whole list of toxins. So when we're talking, I don't know, just through my research, there's about 80 different toxins in the marine environment, and then about you know, another 50 or so in freshwater systems. So just trying to test for all of those would, you know, it's very expensive for one. But, you know, we've tried to rule out all the obvious ones, and so that's why we're really now looking at the marine environment and looking at some of the environmental factors and trying to work out, you know, was there anything particular in any of those years that might have led to this event. I've also been talking to, you know, vets overseas that are used to dealing with sort of mortalities in their areas, and, you know, so far we're all drawing a blank. It's not like we're not trying, but it's not an easy one to solve by any means. I kind of thought the same thing, because what's everyone missing? This should be, you know, should be easy to find, but no, quite a tricky.
They're absolutely normal.
No, so when they open them up, they've got massive red blood cell destruction. So all the cells are kind of, you know, leaking into each other and that kind of thing, particularly in the lungs, particularly in the spleen. But what's causing that? So, yeah, we're...
Councillor Kempton.
Yeah, right at the moment, I mean, there are some, you've got some real challenges. Right at the moment, what can the yellow-eyed penguin, or what is the yellow-eyed penguin trust doing, and what could it do with the resources it has to, at a practical level, to try to arrest the decline? So what kinds of things that you might do on the peninsula and the cabins or even out at sea with your own resources that can do it? Or that can make a difference?
I think the problem is that it's so many different agencies. You know, we're not looking at one thing. So we need to look across the board at all of the different impacts from the terrestrial environment, from the marine environment. And obviously, you know, we do what we can on the terrestrial environment. We manage the pests, we provide, you know, shelter, we do that kind of thing. We're monitoring them throughout the year. We're picking up individual birds when they're injured, they go into rehab, we take them back out. So as much as we can on the ground, we're managing the birds as best we can. What we can't obviously solve is what's going on. You know, we can't manage that very easily, we can't swim out with them, and you know, but that's why we're really focusing on the marine environment now, to try and work out what specifically, you know, we expect it's related to food and it's related to prey and it's, there's a, you know, benthic destruction going on, but we need to look into that a bit further and dig deeper to find out if there's anything that we can do specifically to arrest that.
Can I just add that one thing that we did do for the last 2 years is fund a pop-up penguin hospital. So for sick and injured penguins that were found across our beaches, they would come in and we contracted a specialist avian vet to be down here in Dunedin. Historically, when birds have been injured, they've been flown up to either Massey University or Wellington Zoo if there are substantial injuries that cannot be treated by a local vet. And I mean, that costs the trust significant funds. For doing this, and so a lot of our field work, the terrestrial based field work, has become much more hands on than we ever were historically. We were an organisation that very much believed in a hands off approach to the conservation of yellow-eyed penguins, and in the last few years we've had to quite dramatically change that policy and become much more hands on, where we are literally managing individual birds now.
But now trying to get ahead of the game, you've got to actually
The hospital is the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff.
Yes, yeah.
We need to be putting the resourcing into understanding why.
Councillor Scott.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We provide some funding, yeah. Is there anything more that the regional council could do to assist you in your challenges?
I think particularly with the mass mortality event, any environmental data that you have access to, that we can really start to tease apart what has happened in particular years before these events or during these events that may have led to, you know, I'm thinking particularly of, you know, big rainfall events that have washed something out of a river or that have led to a marine algal bloom or... So you might have access to sources of data that we don't necessarily have, and then if we can, you know, start to pull all these things together, might help to, you know, give that bigger picture of what's actually going on at those kind of times.
But is it principally just this coastline? But you don't, like the Antarctic Islands, is there a similar thing going on there?
Pass. So we know very little about what's going on at the Auckland Islands or Campbell Islands. There's been a little bit of monitoring there, but people aren't there throughout the season. And what we're finding is that this... So in 2012, really the events focused on Boulder Beach sort of area and the beaches around that. This year the 9 birds were found between the Catlins and North Otago. So there was a big spread of, and that doesn't make sense to me. You know, if there was a harmful algal bloom somewhere off the coast, you'd think, you know, it's going to be pinpointed and quite a focused thing. So what is happening that means that a bird right down at Hunahina and a bird that's right up at Moirapi both get affected by the same thing and end up dead? It's not an easy, you know, solvable problem. But I think having some of that data might help.
If you're in work in the Southern Tartu, is phenomenally expensive. And the actual nature of the work is very, very dangerous. Work done. So we can manage only every odd year to join in
As a matter of interest, like you could get down to a small number of penguins here, but how many roughly penguins would there be in those islands? You got any idea at all?
So the major that we haven't really had a good survey done since the 90s, and early 90s. So I'm talking 92, 93. The problem down there is that it's, you know, such a wide area that trying to come and count nests like we would on the mainland is very, very difficult without, you know, a couple of boats that you send down there with a load of people, and we just don't have the resources or the funding and the people to do that, really. So we just don't have the comparable data. So we think there are more birds down there than there are here, and we hope they're not declining like they are here, but we just don't, you know, we can't confirm that for sure.
All right.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, Sue just mentioned that they're genetically different as well. So there is a minor bit of exchange between the subantarctic and the mainland, but you know, less than 2%. So the odd bird would potentially find its way here. So there is that separation. So they're kind of managed as two separate units.
The fledging rate, which looked at about 50% roughly.
Yep.
So that's something that probably can be worked on. I mean, what are most of those mortalities due to?
Early on, there's often there can be predation events. We've, you know, got a pretty good handle on that now. So things like avian diphtheria affect chicks. So that's normally in the first sort of 5 weeks of their life. We didn't have too big of a deal with that down here, at least. They had a big problem in North Otago with avian diphtheria this year, and they lost at least 50% of their chicks through avian diphtheria there. So you end up with these you know, big crusty lesions in the mouth, which mean that they get really dehydrated, they can't feed properly, and they get aspiration pneumonia and end up swallowing some of these lesions and choking as well. So we, you know, we do, if we go out and we find this, we're actively removing these lesions and things to give them that better chance of survival if we can get to them in time. I mean, we're actively monitoring these nests and trying to do everything that we can.
And any chick trampling in the nest by inexperienced parents.
Mm.
If you get the breed in the first year, you're doing all right, but the chicks may not be through that.
And the thing that we're also finding is that there's a big sex skew in the population, so we're finding that there are a lot more males than there are females. So, I mean, we've always known that females have a higher mortality rate, and that's just been a thing that we've known since the 50s. But now, because they're reduced to such low numbers, I think the males are all hoping for a nesting attempt, and so they're actively disturbing the nesting pair on the nest. So much so that, you know, this year we noted one on a camera that just got up and walked off the nest and said, you know, had enough of this hassle. And we went back to that nest and later found both chicks, you know, one chick was missing and one chick was dead outside the nest. So
boys, eh?
Yeah. So those sort of demographic changes because of the population is, not good either.
All right. Thank you very much, Eric, Sue and Trudy. We really appreciate the work you're doing, the passion and enthusiasm. Clearly we're happy to support, but also appreciate your time today to update us on the work you're doing and the challenges you're facing.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, and welcome Adam Utendale and Rachel O'Zane. Join us for the next couple of items on our agenda. Move straight on then to the Director's Report, Dr. Palmer. Item one, and Alpine Lakes, monitoring Lake Snow, an update there, and one project to we were part of, partnering with, unsuccessful, but another couple of projects passed the first round.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I've just given you an update generally on the Alpine Lakes and Lake Snow work. As the Chairman says, there's a report there on the MB bid, and Dr. Utendale will be happy to talk about that. Updated you on the bid by Dr. Novus, which is around the second round in terms of his work, the genetics work that's progressing, an update on the tropic sampling program, and then just a reminder that the State of the Environment Water Quality Review is underway, and we are undertaking that work, and that will inform our long-term plan preparations.
Thank you. And I just note that as a result of larger Catchment Otago project not proceeding on, that staff will consider how to progress aspects of the research that were relevant to ORC during the preparation of our LTP.
Yeah, that's correct. And so at Appendix A, I've reproduced for ease of reference the appendix that was in the report that went to March committee, where committee endorsed the research program of this council for 17-18. And in there it sets out the things that were part of the MB bid that are relevant to our Lake Snow interest. And as the Chairman says, we'll be looking to see how we might pursue those through the LTP in collaboration with the other regional councils.
All right. Any questions on that aspect of the director's report? Good comprehensive update. Councillor Scott?
Yeah, sorry, I just missed that. I just mentioned Councillor Law what we're talking about here. But in relation to this table, Dr. Palmer, through the chair, Appendix A, so what are we saying? That all the high immediate we're committed to in funding, and then what about the medium term on this? Is it just...
Okay. Well, through you, Mr. Chair, if I just, for avoidance of doubt, take you through the table, if that's helpful. Okay, so the first row there, investigation of cell genetics, it's got ORC as the lead agency.
Yeah.
That is the work that's underway at the minute.
DNA work.
Second row, comprehensive examination of the New Zealand diatom samples. We've budgeted for that in 17-18, and subject to Council signing off the annual plan for 17-18, that will take place in 17-18. As will the row below that, the $56,000 for the four priority lakes, the historical dynamics. So the first page is already covered.
And that funding's part of the 100 that we were discussing.
That's here. Correct, that's part of the 100. So we've got $11,000 plus $56,000. Then over the page, the second row there, the literature review, $3,000. Again, it's budgeted for in 17-18. That's the third item. Yeah. The third row in that table, the light orange 2A2, that was part of the MB bid, so that's what will be considered for part of LTP potentially.
So the bid that missed out?
That's correct, the bid that missed out, that's correct.
Well, put a line through that.
So that won't proceed because the MB bid won't proceed, but what we're saying is we'll consider as to whether that's something that should be funded, say, by regional councils through LTP. So we'll give that further consideration. The next row down is a sort of medium importance, medium term thing. We'll think about that as well. Then over the page, there's an activity there that's high immediate, $10,000 ORC. Again, that's budgeted for in 17-18.
Okay.
Top of the page, got that. The second row is part of the MB bid that did not succeed. And you'll see there that there was 3 years of work at about $200,000 per annum. So that will be considered through LTP.
Sorry, which one was that?
2C. 2C. Study of the relationships between diatom, polysaccharide, overproduction.
2C. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And then the bottom part of that table is the work that Dr. Novus is seeking funding for, which has now got through to the second round consideration. Okay.
Three.
Yep. And then on the final page of that table, item four, how might the spread of Lindavia Intermedia between lakes be stopped or slowed? That work is underway by the Ministry for Primary Industry, so that's looking at sanitation methods, and that was identified by the experts in December as a high priority immediate time frame activity. That work's underway.
Is the clean dry appropriate?
That's right. Is that appropriate? That work's underway. And then the last one there, supporting citizen science, $10,000 ORC, that's in 17-18, that's budgeted for. So the four or five rows in that table that are budgeted for 17-18 come to $90,000, and that's what we have in our annual plan.
Okay, so there's nothing in there that's got a cross that has been written off, even if it's been rejected by the government agency. And this, all these, and these are all the recommendations from the experts forum.
Panel.
And so, from your perspective, there's not really any gaps in the plan moving forward.
It's either already being funded, or about to be funded in an annual plan, subject to sign off, or will be considered as part of the long-term plan development.
Yeah. And if I gave you an extra $100,000, you're saying you don't need it.
I'm not saying I don't need it. I'm saying that because the stuff that was to be MB funded was about $800,000. So there's quite an amount of activity in that big. We're getting into big dollars. That was part of the MB bid, along with the other stuff that was not specific to Lake Snow, but was more generally related to lakes. And we're saying that will be considered as part of long-term plan. I should also say that the priorities were also somewhat sequential, in the sense that some of the lesser priority activities, whether and how you implemented them, depended on the early part of the research program. So even if you had the money available for it now, you'd probably defer starting that work till we've got the early parts done.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah. Okay.
And Dr. Palmer, The project, if it had proceeded, the table catchments, there was quite a process to go through before final approval, which means it was going to be 2018 before the project started. Am I correct on that?
Dr. Udenthaler can talk about the time frame a bit more, but it went to a second round and it had to pass that before it actually proceeded.
Yeah.
But the time frame.
That's right. Yeah. So you'd be looking towards this calendar year before they had the final nod, and then by the time contracts and everything were signed, you'd be looking, you know, towards the.
And a subsequent question, if I may, Mr. Chair. So, what's their vision for this lake tonight? Like, is the aim to eliminate fibres research?
Palmer, can you answer that?
The immediate aim is to answer the question: is it an invasion or not? That is the immediate question that we're focusing on at the moment, because that determines work streams and responsibilities and whatever. So the focus at the minute is on where might this have come from, how long has it been here, and that's the advice of the experts.
And it's a reasonable sort of question. I think it's a good question from the ORC's perspective, because as you said, it sorts out our work streams and so forth. But if it wasn't for that, Joe Puntron's street, what's the key question in their mind is basically how can I solve it, not where it came from and whose responsibility it is. Like, are we losing time here by answering the question?
No, based on the advice of the experts, those are the questions that have to be answered before you can then get to the questions around what you would do to control it. You cannot answer the control question until you understand what drives it. So there's some fundamentals that you have to start with.
Okay. Thank you.
Councillor Rollinson.
Thank you very much for the report, and it's very comprehensive and strategic. There's a lot going on. It's really good, and planning for future work. But yeah, in response to Councillor Scott as well, just thinking about that, what if it is a native species that's taken off for some reason, we were trying to eliminate a native species, we, you know, that isn't what we're aiming for until we understand exactly what it is, and it probably is a pest imported from somewhere else, but we don't know that at all. We can't go around mucking around with and potentially native species.
Couples.
You could lie, but it's causing a problem. I mean, if you have an infestation of anything, if there's something that's imbalanced and it's become a plague, you don't just go, oh shit, we won't touch that, it's native. It's still a plague. But anyhow, putting all that to one side, and
that's true, it's native.
So the next issue here is, I'd like to know what is in that IMBY failed bid from the lake from the catchments, the Otago catchments, and what element of that we might pick up given that it has been rejected. I was told that there was a paper to that effect, or the information to that effect was going to be coming to this council today. I don't see it here.
Well, that's just what's been discussed.
No, that's just the lake snow that I'm seeing here.
Well, that's your question, and that's the priority list that Dr. Palmer's just worked through.
Yeah, but it was more than about the late snow and the IMBY application from Catchment Otago.
Oh. So Dr. Udenthal can elaborate on those other bits that go with it. So the lake snow component was about $800,000, and I've identified that in the table at the end. And then there were some other things which included stakeholder engagement and those sorts of things, which I'm sure Dr. Udenthal can elaborate on the wider bit.
Dr. Udenthal.
Yeah, thank you. I guess the wider bit was really comprehensive and really detailed. My understanding is that is freely available. I don't think there's any intellectual property issues with that being circulated. I can certainly find out from the catchment to Otago. The work was really focused on, I guess, developing an integrated catchment management plan for the Great Southern Lake throughout the South Island, so as far south as Lake the Territory,
yeah,
all the way north through the Canterbury Lake.
Yeah.
It had a very strong social and cultural focus included in it, and also, I guess, a large component of it was really understanding the interactions between land use and nutrient loss, and I guess the collect the information to really understand what makes those lakes tick. So really looking to develop lake catchment models to be used for forecasting and help us really understand, I guess, scenarios for land management moving forward. So we're looking to, I know that Environment South and ECAM were very disappointed that bid didn't get through. And Dean Olsen, the science manager, has been in contact and organised a catch-up within the coming weeks with key staff from those organisations to work through that bit and really understand, well, what collectively is it that we would like to see progress. And as Mr. Palmer mentioned, we'd be pushing that through, I guess, to the LTP planning.
And that's the point I wanted to pick up, you see, because it seems to me that if the government's not going to do it, then Environment South and ECAMs and ourselves, as you identify, could pick up in particular those areas. I'm interested in your disappointment, though, and the disappointment of those other regional councils, because that disappointment suggests to me that you'd like to do that research so that you know better the state of the Alpine Lakes and how potentially to treat any problems that might be coming that way. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Me as a scientist, I'd love to see that work progress.
Yeah, yeah. And that's good. So, see, that's why I wanted that. I mean, I want to see us investigate this, Mr. Chairman, as to whether or not we can, if the government is going to fail to come to the party, the three regional councils can get involved in this, and I'd like us to progress that with alacrity. Is that possible?
So my response is that that's essentially happening, and from a time frame perspective, with some time, and Dr. Udenthal's just touched on it, the understanding what bits that are relevant and necessary for the regional councils, and pulling that together maybe in a package for our LTPs is a sensible timeframe.
Well, that was the next question I was going to ask. The bits have been identified here on this appendix A.
Yep.
That was going to be covered by the embed, but now aren't. There is nobody else stepping up for that, is there?
No,
I've run through Mr. Chairman. When the bid, and it was a hastily prepared bid, was discussed, so this is the MB bid, was discussed at the Upper Clinton Water Users Group, the scientists that were proposing it were saying that if they weren't successful this time, they would put a revised bid into the next funding round. So that's the other part of this equation, as to what do they think goes into another subsequent funding application.
Right.
Because they're in this business the whole time, and you know, applications are made by universities and COIs all the time for funding.
Yep.
And this one happened to fail, as most of them do.
But what I don't want to see is us waiting for another 12 months while we look at their bill to see whether or not we actually get involved in this. I mean, the great fear is that you actually do that, say, oh, well, wait for the revised bid, you know, it might go there. Yes, it might get declined again. As you quite rightly say, there are lots of competing bids and there's very scarce funds. These are considered by the scientists, though, as the necessary steps for us to take to understand the late snow issue. That's the question I'm asking. The bits that have missed out of the catchments Otago, are we intending to put into our long-term community plan next, or long-term plan or not next year?
Well, Dr. Palmer, I think, answered that. But
the answer is that we are contemplating doing that.
Yeah.
Because you see that as necessary to progressing the late snow investigation.
That's correct.
Potential control.
That's correct. That's what the experts told us.
Yes. So if that doesn't work, we've got to pick it up whether we like it or not.
I'm not saying we necessarily have to. I'm saying it's certainly being considered by staff in terms of preparing a long-term plan for consideration by council. We've been advised by the experts that is part of the Lake Snow thing, and so it's our intention to look at this and contemplate getting it into a long-term plan for funding, part funding or whatever, yep, by this council.
So it's not a you must do. There's an option. Let's look at what bits are relevant. And let's also understand whether there's an ability to partner with fellow neighbouring regional councils and progress from there.
Yep.
And as we build a long-term plan, we're going to be better informed with the results of the work that's right underway right now, such as the DNA work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which might help with some of the detail of the next stage. All right, any further questions? Thank you. I'm just conscious of time. I'm going to keep pushing along. We're going to have a very long day if we're not. Well, we're going to have it anyway. We're going to have to go into this evening. Yes, correct. Item 2, climate change adaption. Any questions there or anything, Dr. Palmer, you would like to highlight? Update there. Geomorphic change detection. You'll see some partnering there with some international work. Sounds exciting. Everybody comfortable? Flood forecasting capabilities and update. And a Faroe Stream flood hazard investigation and an update there.
I'm happy to move to report.
Is noted also an update there on the lease with some photos for your report. Thank you. Is there a second up? Councillor Hope, I'll put it. All in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Item 2, traffic level status for Lake Waipori and Lake Waihola. Detailed as a result of 2014-2016 monitoring and good detailed report there, and pleasing to see there has been some improvement in Lake Waihola, and I'd be interested, Dr. Palmer, in some in your response there, and just around the different trophic status, but the movement within the trophic status.
Yes, so I might defer to Ian for that explanation and expert interpretation of that, if you don't mind.
The way that this report was done, there's been three periods of traffic level monitoring for Lake Waipori, and so the only way that we could do long-term trend analysis was to look at the three periods. One was 1997-98, one was 2002-04, and the latest one just done. So obviously there's quite a lot of gaps in between. But we did find Lake Waihola and Waipori have remained at the same trophic state, so they're still eutrophic. They're still in that TLI band. The TLI ranges from 1, which is super, to hypertrophic, which is extremely high nutrients. So eutrophic is just a high nutrient level in the lake, which is expected because it's a lowland shallow lake. So the actual trophic lake data hasn't changed, or trophic level index hasn't changed over that period. But what is interesting is that the total phosphorus, particularly in Lake Waihola, is significantly decreasing. And that's one of the components that makes up the trophic level index. So you've got the total nitrogen, total phosphorus, and chlorophyll. So the total phosphorus is certainly decreasing in Lake Waihola. We don't actually know why. And the other interesting thing about the whole report I found was that in the Waipori River, which is a pretty pure river, we've got significant decreasing levels of total phosphorus, and that's the main input into Lake Waipori, Lake Waihola, as well as the tidal influence. So it's not been a trophic level index change,
no.
But there's a significant trend.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, anything else you wish to point out?
No, thank you.
Open it up for questions. We've got a smile on your face, Councillor Scott.
Six A's working, Brian.
Is that so?
Six A's working.
That's good.
What is it all about, no? We'll have to talk about it in the next report as well.
Yeah. One of the pod.
I was a little bit surprised. The 4.55 going to 4.58, but you're saying underlying that is the phosphate, this TLI number. You know, you're saying it's improving significantly, Rachel.
For total phosphorus. Yes.
For total phosphorus.
Yes. And that's one component of the TLI.
That's one component, yes. Okay. And that's not to do with, you know, people putting less or more manageable superphosphate on their farms or in the catchment?
Who knows? I mean, with the Lake Waipori, Waihola, they're so shallow that a lot of the total phosphorus might well be to do with reef suspension and wind and just the when you happen to be farming. So I think it's a wee bit tenuous, but that's the science we've got to go on. So it might well be. We know that there's a significant decrease in all that sort of thing in the main drain, which is also an input into Lake Waipori.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. And, I mean, what's the future for Waihola and Waipori? What are they going to look like in 50 years' time?
They're not going to change the state. I mean, realistically, they're not. They're lowland shallow lakes, and they've got an awful lot of nutrient locked up in the sediment, particularly phosphorus. So they're not going to turn into a Wapitipu or a Wanaka. They're going to remain the same, and it would be just good if we can manage the chlorophyll so that we don't get the sun bacteria outbreaks
okay.
We've been getting.
Thank you.
So the other main contributor here is the tidal influence, as you say, but there's also a lot of sediment arrives in Lake, both those lakes, but particularly Lake Waipola, from the Tauri River and flood events.
Yes.
Yeah. Three contributing, and the majority of that sediment, again, generalisation, comes out of the Kaibu.
Yes, possibly, yeah. I mean, the main contributor to the is the Waipori River.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yes,
definitely in
Kaibu
would be
that.
Questions?
Sorry. Just a quick one. The Lake Hayes, Tui Kunapitili, who you know one, and Tom Hawk.
Tuakatoto.
Yeah, Tuakatoto, that's what I was saying.
I didn't recognise it from your attempt.
They have some similarity. Wait, hold on. Question.
Well, they're in the same group in our plan. So yeah.
So I'm just thinking in terms of the work that we do on those lakes. Is that going to be of any relevance to Waihola? Are there going to be learnings from that help us with our understanding of Lake Waihola, or if we were ever thinking of any kind of restoration, would it be the same story?
His own plan to comment in a minute, but there's different drivers for those three projects in our 17-18 annual plan. The thing about Tomahawk is that some people complain when the water level is too high, some people complain when the water level is too low. And so the Tomahawk issue is about getting an agreed community vision of how you want the lagoon to operate and sand mining and sorts of things. Tuakitoto is a situation where we own it, and we have not renewed grazing licences around the edge of it, so we have to make a decision as an owner how we want the riparian margin to look. Do we want to plant it out, or how do we want to control it? So that's a slightly different issue. And then the haze is the historical phosphate issue that we've talked about in the past. So three different drivers for those three different projects, even if they share some similarities probably in terms of the chemistry.
Thank you.
The other point I was going to make about Lake Wahola is there has been, and Waipori, the whole wetland complex, there has been a significant community effort in weed control, and regional council also with willow control around the fairway of the waterway over the last decade really, and I just note that. Alright, any questions?
Happy to move the recommendation.
Thank you, yeah. Councillor Neal. Seconded Councillor Hope. I'll put it all in favour. Please say aye.
Aye.
And carried. Thank you. Bearing that in mind, Dr. Palmer, are we intending, and certainly the next report I was going to ask the same question, reporting to the community in any way with the outcomes of these reports? For example, a meeting in Waihola Hall with Waihola looking forward, or whatever they call themselves now?
I'm not sure of the arrangements around stakeholder engagement, but we will. I'm not sure if we're going to confirm
that question.
Firm plans.
Certainly, the next one we'll come to now is one where I think there's some able to. All right, item three: Waira River catchment water quality study. Dr. Palmer, who do you want to hand that to? Give us an overview.
Ms. Ozan has been very busy. She can answer any questions. I'm sure.
Sorry. Yeah, Rachel.
So would you like me to just give you a quick summary?
Yes, please.
Right. So the Waira catchment is quite small. It's only 2,200 kilometres square. It's actually, when you look at it, it's in an agricultural landscape. The upper catchment is mainly tufted, the extent of sheep and beef. When you get to the lowlands, there's a bit of dairy going on there. You look at the actual river, it's got beautiful riparian margins generally with a lot of bush and flax and natives and so on. The substrate is fabulous, it's got boulders, cobbles, gravel, everything that you need for a good healthy river, and especially ecologically. We know from our state of environment monitoring, which we do at the bottom of the catchment, we do that on a monthly basis and have done since 2006, that it's not got particularly good water quality. It's not a disaster, but we get high nutrients and bacteria and so on. Again, in that river, there's been a wee bit of improvement in phosphorus. Seems to be a common theme. And in the catchment monitoring, again, throughout the whole catchment, the water quality was not where we'd like it to be, particularly in terms of our plan limits we had 13 sites on the catchment, and we never looked at it properly in terms of ecology, and it was, and I think that was the main surprise. In a catchment that's not intensive particularly, it's got a lot of sheep and beef and so on in the other catchment, there wasn't much in the main stem river. There's a lot of sediments, a lot of algae, and so much so that it's not at any spaces or any chance for macroinvertebrates to live, and obviously macroinvertebrates are fish food, so there wasn't a lot of fish around either. But looking at the river, as I say, you wouldn't have spotted that. So that I think poses a question for all of us. It's extensive farming, and we're getting a lot of sediment runoff from the hills. But it, as I said, it's not an intensive point source. It's everywhere. The only good thing we can take away is that phosphorus is improving down at the bottom there, what else have I got to say? Clinton oxidation pond has a wee bit of an impact downstream in the Kurawea stream.
What was that, sorry?
The Clinton oxidation pond. Yes.
On the tributary.
But I mean, but not severe.
All right. Thank you. Questions, was that?
One quick question on Lake Wahola. the cyanobacteria blooms that blighted the summer for many recreational users in Dunedin and Woden Field. That's connected to the phosphorus and the nitrogen levels, what?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And so you're saying nothing can be done about that because they're already in sediment.
What I'm saying is that Lake Waihola and Lake Borey have got high levels of nutrients. And yeah, that's unlikely to change. It's a eutrophic water body. So I don't know how that could change. And we don't know why some years we have blooms and some years we don't.
So there's no treatment that you can provide to either of those lakes that will mitigate the rise of those bacterial blooms?
I should think if you throw enough, a huge amount of money at it, something's always possible. But you have to bear in mind that those lakes are very shallow, there's a lot of sediment, and they're very nutrient rich. And they're a wetland, they're in part of wetland landscapes and by inference that means they're highly productive.
The Bay of Plenty.
Jim, we're finished on those lakes and we're actually on the Wairoa River now.
Yeah. The Bay of Plenty here has a number of similar sort of lakes with similar sorts of problems. And they are currently being treated by the Bay of Plenty Regional Council in various ways. Are you saying that they'll be able to be probably more successfully treated because they're deeper than the shallow lakes that they're likely in?
No, I think I'm just saying that because they are so shallow, and the shallow lowland lakes are known to be very productive, and it would be incredibly difficult to rid them of that productivity.
You can fall off your water skis and stand up in sediment. And
yes, you can.
So
yeah, you can't. All right. You can't take a jet boat around half of it because it's too shallow.
Yeah. All right. On to the Wairoa report. Questions, Councillor Scott?
Yeah. Look, despite the ray of sunshine on the previous report, I was gutted by this report. You know, and also the survey, communication survey, just in terms of where the farming community is at, you know, like I think it's 12% of them have done water testing and so forth. And because the feedback that I've been getting from South Otago from yourself, Mr. Chair, is that it's all go, you know, there's positive things happening. Well, I don't see it in this report.
No.
We'll just leave it at that. And these guys need to get the message to whoever's responsible for this that 2020 is not too far away.
I agree. I was disappointed, and particularly disappointed in Mrs. Zane's, you know, the amount of sediment in this waterway. There is some quite intensive stuff up the top end of the catchment also, and there's clearly been some land development or something occurring. But the sediment's through the whole lot.
The whole catchment.
Yeah.
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 And the interesting thing about the Wairoa is that it usually waterfall fields degrades as it moves downstream, but the waterfall field in this catchment was the same from the top
to the bottom. Okay. Yep. So that is disappointing for me, and I think we can use it as an example. We need to take it to the community.
Yes.
And be clear and blunt and say, hey guys, and so there's an opportunity there for the education side of the organisation, in my view. Councillor Kenton.
Yeah, look, I was going to make that point that I think there's an opportunity pretty much everywhere, and sometimes if you get to get a really good catchment response, you've actually got to have an excuse to go and talk to the catchment. This is the excuse, but at the same time, is it reasonable for those in the know at ORC to have a chat with a couple of champions who actually live there, so that when we do go and have that meeting, there's a chance that one of them is going to say, hey guys, we've got to get a group going here. And somebody says, oh, certainly that point, and where we are, we've got a catchment, a quality group, at the very least, going in this catchment. And so I wonder sometimes whether there is homework that we can do at a personal level with the people in the catchment, so that when we go, there's a fair chance we'll get a result, which is not just, all right, we'll go home and think about it, but we've actually got a group working here, and what are we going to be doing next?
Yeah, and there was a group there.
that was evident through the minimum
wage
process. The minimum, you know, there was a group of people, whatever you call them, that were supposedly looking in the right direction, and some key personalities.
Can I just say that we did keep the community informed?
Yeah.
And so the ecology has only just come through, so they don't know about that yet. But with all the quality results, they're all very interested in every sampling round day. The key people were sent updates. So,
good. But here's the wrap up, the whole report is here. All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I mean, this report and just been a few comments, and Councillor Scott might like to say. You know, on one hand, we're having discussions about the community coming to us saying, hands off ORC, because we might get scared as farmers that you might prosecute us. And then we have this response, and some of you are saying, get tough with them.
Yeah, good point.
So please, I mean, you know, because at the end of the day, we do have a water plan, and the water plan is very descriptive as to what they need to be doing if they're going to be compliant with the plan in 2020.
Yeah.
And I would argue that we need to be up this creek measuring individual farm discharges and providing that information to those farmers. We can't prosecute them yet unless they are discharging dairy effluent directly into land or on a stream. So we can go in there and say, we can't prosecute you on your 2020 stuff, schedule 16, but we can tell you what it is. And I think that's where we've got to get active with these groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's my view of the thing. But people are scared that we were doing it because it might give, I don't know, we had that discussion earlier. So if there are mixed messages.
No, there is. He's absolutely right. We do give mixed messages. And I'm just as guilty of that as anybody else on this issue. And I feel sorry for you, Peter, because you do have to put up with us in our discussions. The reality is that if we are going to have an impact upon farming practice, we've actually got to tell individual farmers this is the impact that you're having. But the problem is we've just had this report and this discussion and we're moving on to the next one. Remember I say to you we don't actually come to a conclusion to the reports we have because we don't resolve what to do from it? Well, this is the classic. Now, I'd like to see that message given to farmers in terms of the information and for them to be able to be informed so that they can make informed decisions. And so, Peter, I'd like to see you take that report and say, right, this is how I would translate that report into activity into the farmers in this particular area. This is how we would communicate it. This is how we would propose to measure. And can we ask that as a consequence of today? And then we could all be on the same page. But I'm equally as guilty as anybody here at giving a mixed message. So let's give Peter that message now.
So Scott?
I would also almost go so far as to say or suggest that consideration be given to this catchment for one of the catchment risk assessments. And actually, here's the independent, well, here's the scientific report, here's this next step, and I think there'll be learnings for everybody out there.
Good point.
Well, what are we going to do now, Stephen?
The community liaison team will have a look at, I think we've sort of unofficially agreed, we can put it in a recommendation if you like, report, this full report to the community. And I think the environmental assessment in this catchment might be as well. And part of that meeting saying, hey, we're starting this work and guess what, you're one of the ones first off the block. Councillor Robson.
Yeah, I think just keep in mind though that it isn't the only one across the table. It is the one that we happen to pick on in a targeted study, but there's a number of them across the Otago that have got similar issues or aren't meeting current standards. We do need, I take Councillor Laws's point, a comprehensive look at how we're going to deal with that, because obviously Mr Bodick is still wondering, do we go now up catchments, and once we find an issue we're monitoring each property, he hasn't got an answer to that. We haven't got an answer to that right now, but it is a question that's being posed. We need a strategic approach to what do we do once we've got that in between now and 2020. And also we need to be going out to this is all policy, not technical as well, so it needs to go into that realm or regulatory, but looking at communicating with the farming sector and other sectors that this was a business, this is not farming as usual. We've got the same message again. Waiwera is not an intensive catchment, yet we've got serious issues and we need you to address them right across the Otago, not just this catchment, because it's not the only one, and saying that message clearly again.
Alright, the recommendation is that we note this request from memory.
I see the note.
Am I correct? So the report and the technical report, Water Quality Study Waira River, received and noted. Move to Councillor Noon, seconded Councillor Bell.
Is that strong enough? I mean, can we just have this discussion so that we actually want the comms team to come back to us with a bit of strategy on what they're going to do now with this report and communicate it to us? Isn't that really what we're after?
Yes, it is, but we've taken that as a given.
Well, we won't be there in a minute, Stephen. You know, we need to give the staff a clear direction from governance about what we expect the next threat to be, and I'd like that recorded in a minute.
Quite happy. I'm happy to second that.
Stakeholder engagement plan proposal.
It's brought to the next committee round.
Quite happy.
That's been accepted by the mover and seconded. I put it all in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Yes, carried. Thank you. I declare the technical meeting closed, and we're going to conclude very quickly the financial report meeting.